Good day. This is the making of the John Batchelor Show. I am he. The headlines press upon me. I did not want to just do war today, but it's... You might not be interested in war, John, but war is interested in you. So I report, sadly, the news that the Houthis are getting into the game, according to the latest release in the last 12 hours. And they're naming the Bab al-Mandeb as their target. That's the Red Sea and the choke point of Bab al-Mandeb. Saudi Arabia pumps most of its oil out through the Red Sea, not through the Strait of Hormuz. This is the second vulnerable waterway to Iranian bad acting. And at the same time, we have this surprising report. This is the Telegraph London reporting. U.S. has launched Hellfire missiles at an oil tanker approaching Karg Island on the fifth night of strikes in the Strait of Hormuz. U.S. Central Command said it had disabled the merchant vessel by firing a precision missile into the ship's smokestack after it, quote, ignored multiple warnings. The Belma, a Caraco-flagged vessel, had been attempting to sail towards the island, Iran's main oil export terminal, the agency added. So in addition to Iran firing at unarmed tankers, the U.S. is now firing at unarmed tankers. This is not a positive development. It requires lots of attention and turning over. I welcome my colleague, Simon Constable of the Wall Street Journal and Barron's and other distinguished publications. He is in the south of France. And we're going to do a generally upbeat report on climate, commodities, and longevity. But we begin with these headlines because there they are, waiting all of the East Coast and the Midwest and the West Coast of the U.S. Simon, my quick measure, good morning to you, good afternoon to you in France, is that this is not a positive development, striking a tanker on its way into Karg Island and having the Houthis threaten the Bab al-Mandeb, the Houthis unconquered from the first phase of the war. How does this all strike you, Simon, in the south of France? Good day to you, Simon.
Good day to you, John, and thanks for having me on the show. This is bad news all around. When bombs are being sent, whether they're by missiles or other purposes or other ways like drones and all the rest of it, this is not good. When investors are looking at risks, they'll be looking at this and saying, okay, well, that will mean there's a risk that we have less or smaller amounts of oil coming out of the Strait of Hormuz, and that will mean that we'll all pay a lot more for energy. And that's not good at all. We need the prices to go down, or at least maybe every country in the world drills down to get more oil. This is just not good. We don't need this.
Yes, it's the complications here are obvious, Simon and myself, because we've worked through this for months. And we had a moment where the price of Brent crude was headed back to the moderate prices of before the war, but no more. And we'll tell that story. I just mentioned that I do not like the idea of Hellfire missiles fired into an unarmed ship. I just don't like it.
I don't think anyone likes it, John. It's warships maybe having a battle with each other. That's one thing. But a civilians moving cargo around that is not hurting anybody. That just seems bad.
Yes, I'm certain that the tanker was headed in to take on a load of oil, and that would have contributed to Iranian income. But we're not making war on the Iranian civilian population doing its business of maintaining the infrastructure. We're making war on, well, there is a question, because I don't have an easy answer to it. Who are we making war on? The president is addressing the nation in the next hours. I believe Thursday night was the original announcement, pending decisions to be made in the war fighting. But in any event, the expectation is that the president will give us an address he did not give us in February 28th or March 1st at the start of the war, which is why we fight. What is the mission? And where is victory? And how close are we to victory? And will this war end with a positive outcome or status quo? And why are we attacking unarmed vessels in the Strait of Hormuz? Simon, I'm just thinking how this will play in Al Jazeera. My goodness, Simon.
It will do very badly on Al Jazeera. Right? It will not look good. It's one of those things where you call it in journalism, we call it optics. You know, how does this look on the front page of the Sun newspaper or the Daily Express or Washington Post? It's not going to look good. Hopefully this war is over soon, so all the soldiers and sailors and airmen can all come home safely. That's what everybody wants. And you know, yes, we there are some issues with Iran and the leaders of Iran between the U.S. and Iran. That is not a good situation, but that's better done by talk.
It reminds me of those so-called drug boats that were targeted by Southcom in the run-up to the Venezuelan tragedy. Shooting at an unarmed boat, Simon, there's no century where that comes out positively. I can't think of a century or a decade or a moment.
Well, the thing I always note is that basically, in terms of the media and the newspaper business, you're guilty until proven innocent in the newspapers. I mean, it's not a criminal thing to upset the newspapers, but they basically, you know, will say something and then people will have to backpedal, and that will be the situation. And it's not good.
The article goes on to report, American strikes expanded into northern Iran on Thursday morning. That's now in the Middle East, which is 8 to 9 hours ahead of the clock on the East Coast. While Iran retaliated by attacking U.S. bases in Jordan, Kuwait, and Bahrain, the president warned that he would target Iranian power plants if the Islamic Republic did not return to peace talks by next week. Asked if Iran had a deadline before the attacks, the U.S. president said, "I don't like giving deadlines, but they pretty much know. They know that the story. They better behave." Oh, This is not a good imitation of FDR, if that's what it's meant to be. Okay, Simon, we're going to turn to something that isn't Hellfire missiles into an unarmed vessel, which I'm sure has an explanation, but you don't get a second paragraph when you're shooting people, civilians who are not armed, especially civilians from a nationality you know not. These are not Iranian IRGC members manning that boat. These are professional sailors on an oil tanker. Under contract, and it's flagged in another sovereign state, and it's doing its business of delivering energy to probably China, maybe India, maybe Turkey, but in any event, it's not doing anything illegal. Where is the courtroom here? Okay, stop, Tom. Listen, Simon, here's what I want to accomplish today. First of all, to greet your charming self, a very good afternoon in France. Tell me the weather, because you've had heat waves hanging over Central Europe for some days.
Well, the last few days have been rather hot, but not as hot as last week. And today, actually, it's a bit cooler than I had expected, which is great. And I'm really happy out there. I don't immediately start sweating. The high today will be 91, so that'll be quite high. The low was 70, which is a beautiful temperature. I'll love 70 for the rest of my life. It's a good amount of Fahrenheit, and I can really like that. You've got blue skies and a little bit of cloud cover, depending on where you're looking. But it's not a bad day at all. And I think tomorrow we're going to get some rain, which is much needed because we haven't seen rain for a very long time. It's almost like a drought.
I report on my weather, which is puzzling. The sky is smoky orange overcast, not because of the El Nino effect, not because of a storm out there coming from the west. No, it's the smoke from the wildfires in Canada. And we're living with warnings of bad air quality, have been for 24 hours. So your throat gets scratchy and you think, am I coming down with something? No, you're breathing. It's worse in the cities because they're always poor quality. I mention this only because I read the alarmist green technology press. I read it routinely. This is a super El Nino year, declared almost completely. So There's reason to pay attention to the weather patterns.
And we've also got, here in France, we've had a number of wildfires that were absolutely terrifying, but both in France and Spain over the last weeks or so. And it's terrifying because part of the regulations in Spain is you can't take up the scrub that is basically a tinderbox for fires. So if you drop a cigarette that's still lit, that could basically burn thousands of hectares. That's you know, two acres per hectare. But it can happen very, very quickly and move at sort of one kilometer, you know, a minute, which is really fast.
We're not collecting disaster stories. We're reporting the news.
Sorry, I didn't mean to go off piste there.
The literature on wildfires suggests that we are more, not less, exposed to them because of the pattern of the weather. The rains bring the undergrowth very quickly. And then the drought or the dry temperatures of the heat, which is what you've been tolerating or not tolerating these last weeks, then dries up the undergrowth. And then along comes the thunder and lightning storms. It's you don't need a cigarette. You just need a lightning strike on a dried out landscape. That's what happens in Australia. That's what happens in California. Happens in the forests of the West. Happens in France and Spain and Italy. And we're told, in this part I'm just repeating what I've read, we're told that the conditions of storms and drought that are accelerating are conducive to wildfires. That's what we're told. Now, they've always been here. They've been here for thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of years. So I'm not ready to charge down into permanent climate change. I am going to say that because we have built our habitats into ecosystems that are that delicately balanced between fire and drought and rain and growth and then cycle again, we are inviting tragedy. That's the nature of a habitat. Simon lives in a verdure field of glory that has been farmed for generations. But originally it was a forest. And it's balanced when it's a forest. When Simon and his neighbors have clear fields and with game and farm it, it invites trouble. That's the same in Western Australia. It's the same in Western United States. I'm not preaching. I'm just saying that's why we care about these things, because we're living where we didn't used to live.
It's true. It's very true. You've banged the nail on the head. We're absolutely right. Where we are living is the problem.
Yes. Now, we'll turn to something happier, because we have a glorious quiz that Simon has done for the Wall Street Journal that I guarantee everybody will fail. Okay? That's the announcement. I took the first four questions, got all four wrong. No, I got one right. It was a guess, though. I had no knowledge. We'll take that, but we're going to begin with the news reporting that's important to what I've been remarking on, which is not the weather, the climate. Climate and weather are not the same things. Climate is the big picture, what's coming now and how it connects to what's coming later. Super El Nino is climate. What is that? 2 degrees centigrade above normal in the eastern Pacific and central Pacific is El Nino. 2.5 degrees above normal in those same areas is a super El Nino. We've never achieved, to my understanding of record keeping, 3 degrees centigrade above normal. However, it is talked about this year. Hasn't happened, but it is talked about. Why does the water warm? It's straightforward. The trade winds weaken. That's it. Once the trade winds weaken, the Central Pacific gets warmer than regular, and that water moves to the east off the coast of North and South America. It creates conditions that are drought, precipitation, back and forth. And it's not respective of what continent, it's pieces of continent. So right now, Simon's in a zone that's going to see drought in the Super El Nino, which is going to extend into the spring of 27 here in the northern North Temperate Zone, in the northern hemisphere. In the southern hemisphere, Australia, where it is now their winter, it is going to extend into the spring, summer, the next cycle, so they're going to have it longer time. I report on Australia on Saturday nights. That's why I'm so familiar with their pattern. We're going to begin with the positive news that Simon is not melting. And then we'll move to, first of all, his harvest of fruit outside of his office. He lives in a chateau in the south of France. This is a very happy man I'm talking to. And then we're going to do commodity prices that are not going in a good direction. And then we're going to mention England, Argentina. We'll just mention it because Simon and I are not sportscasters. We'll just mention that it turned into an echo of the Malvinas-Falklands conflict of the Thatcher era in the 80s. And that's an unhappy reference, but we need to mention it.
Yes. Yeah.
Then the fact that Britain does not now have a concentrated leadership in the hands of one man whom you're familiar with. There is this a possibility that there will be a new prime minister within hours, maybe Friday morning Britain time. Maybe his name is Burnham, and he's the mayor of Greater Manchester, which is an industrial city Simon knows very well. He tells me it has two excellent football teams. All right. And then we'll turn to the longevity quiz, which I guarantee you're not supposed to feel bad that you failed. We don't hear these things routine enough. Now that I'm in the group as a senior, I care a lot about these numbers. Right now I'm doing fine, Simon. I'm above the national average. I feel good, Simon. You made me feel good.
Well, getting one right, and I've got to remind everybody of this, is that when I write these quizzes, I would have got 0 points. And any correct answers that I would have got would have been by mistake by me, because I really don't know anything about these things that go on. But we're going to get to that a bit later. The Mirabelle plums are basically done at this point, and we're waiting for the damsons, which are the big blue plums, and they're coming through fairly rapidly, but it'll be, I think, another week or two before we can harvest them, and they're doing very well as well. So that's nice, and I'm hoping it gets cooler next week so I can enjoy being outside instead of worrying about whether I'm going to faint, which it was a couple of weeks ago.
Okay, let's put on our professional journalism hats. Pin our little purple hearts for being under fire. Okay, so we're ready. This will be 17 and a half minutes for some hours from now, Simon, on national radio. Here we go. 5, 4, 3. This is the making of the John Batchelor Show, about to become the John Batchelor Show. Hold on. There's some exciting spaniels barking. I don't want to record excitement. What it is, Simon, is that the workmen show up and they always bring treats, so the spaniels want to get in their face. All right, guys.
They love you.
I know. They were waiting for me to say I'm going to record with Simon to start barking.
Of course.
Of course. Their little timer went off. Oh, he's going to record. Let's go bark.
Woof, woof, woof.
All right. The International Spaniels. Okay, 5, 4, thank you, Simon. 3, 2, 1. I'm John Batchelor. I welcome Simon Constable, writing for Wall Street Journal, Barron's, and other distinguished publications in the south of France, in paradise, but not recently. You may have read the headlines from Europe these last weeks of extremely high temperatures, reminding all of us that Europe is not air-conditioned and built the way the U.S. is. It has older, beautiful buildings, but they're not good for 40 to 44 degrees centigrade. Few things are. So the excitement here has been a melting Europe from London to Paris, certainly to Milan, and throughout the Mediterranean basin. However, Simon, a very good day to you. I understand your weather has moderated. What is it in these 24 hours? Good day, Simon.
Good day, John. It's cooler than it was yesterday, significantly. The low was 70 Fahrenheit and the high 91 Fahrenheit, which is much, much, much better than it being over 100, which it frequently has been in the recent weeks. So I'm very happy with that. I can go out there without risking myself fainting. So extra happy. We've got blue skies and a little cloud cover in certain places in the hemisphere. So it's nice.
You're very dry. You've had a drought. Have you, rain anywhere?
No, except for a light sprinkle a few days ago, but it was a light sprinkle. If we get some thunderstorms, we'll get a lot of rain coming down. We'll hear a thunderclap, and then we'll hear the massive amount of water will be dropping on the house and in the garden, which is much needed at this moment.
And the farmers, they're planting their fields, so these are conditions that are not conducive to good planting, but they're used to it. We move from the climate, and I report my climate is bizarre because I'm living with a smoky orange sky, have been for 24 hours, not because of the weather or the climate. Perhaps the contributing factor to the wildfires of Canada that drift down here over New England all the way down the east coast of the United States. I do not recall this being a condition in the late 20th century. It certainly is becoming commonplace here in New England that wildfires extend for days and spread their detritus all over a large landscape. What is significant to me about the wildfires is that they're said to connect to the climate, and the climate is now said to be certainly a super El Nino, meaning the temperatures in the eastern Pacific will be above normal, and that will change the weather patterns of drought and precipitation all around the world. We will struggle with it as we go forward. However, I'm going to turn to better news because you've mentioned your pears. You've mentioned the blossoms in your garden. My lilies are bursting out, Simon. There is a good reason to be in July. All men are in color. And I'm told for the people who have noses, such as my spaniels, that the garden smells like, well, it smells like lilies. You understand. That is all very happy, but now we turn to the unhappy part, the commodities, and we'll begin with the tough stuff, energy. What do we have this morning on Brent crude, on natural gas, on electricity? Good day to you.
Good day to you. It's very mixed on the energy side of things. So Brent crude is at $85 per barrel. And that's up 7% over the last month. So that's quite a fast move for that. We've got natural gas that's U.S. natural gas at $2.91 per unit. And that's down 7.4%. So that's something that I think Americans should be very happy with. And then European Union gas, which is TTF, that's 54.5 euros per megawatt hour. And that's up 30% over the last month. So that's an incredible move there. And that's not going to be good for anyone in the European Union. So I'm going to be one of those people and hoping that the coolness comes soon to us. Going down, we've got gold, which is down 5%, which is not much of a movement at the moment. Silver down 16%. It tends to be much more volatile than gold. And then we've got copper. And this is the worrying bit about this, is when copper goes down, it's really a sign that we've got less of a demand for it, which means the economy is probably slowing down quite a lot. So that's $6.34 per pound, down 2% over the last month. So that's not good. Now, here we've got some good news for the farmers. Soybeans, that's up 7%. Wheat is up 12%, again, over the last month. And corn is up 7%. Remember, a few weeks ago, we were talking about whether these crops would do well without fertilizer. And it looks like the prices going up means they didn't get the fertilizer. But if you've got any plants left, you're going to get paid a lot more for it. And one I missed here was iron ore, which is $99 per metric ton, and that's down 3% in the last month. So, you know, a mixture there, depending who you are and whether you're doing it. So if you're an oil company, you're probably doing well by seeing the Brent crude oil up 7%. But if you're a farmer, you're also happy. And then, you know, if you own some gold, maybe you'll be a bit unhappy.
Here's what I don't entirely solve, but I'll mention. The threat to Bab el-Mandeb, the obvious troubles in the Strait of Hormuz with the U.S. firing on a tanker headed into Cargo Island and the Iranians firing on all manner of cargo ships and tankers, that will be reflected in the price of Brent crude. The Bab el-Mandeb will also be factored in. We don't know where that's going. The possibility is that panic. But we don't see it yet. But, Simon, we were headed down under 70. We were
yes,
in the 60s.
We're right there. We're right there, which is in a great sweet spot where right. Everybody, the producers could get a decent living from that, and the consumers would be relatively happy with that. And now we've gone backwards right. into a which place where, yeah, the producers are going to be very happy, but the buyers are not.
I mentioned also, do you have a quote on fertilizer, on urea? I didn't ask you to get one, but I have a reason. Here's why. One of the strikes by the Ukrainian drones, it's now a drone war between Ukraine and Russia, was at the major petrochemical plant 1,300 kilometers from Ukraine that produces the fertilizer, the chemicals that are necessary for the fertilizer for Russia's export. And that was hit in the last week, burning, said to be under control, but not producing as it does. So that will be reflected in that price of fertilizer coming out of Russia.
Absolutely. It will. The good news for everyone is that setting up a fertilizer plant only requires natural gas because we've got the other gases in the atmosphere, which bind together, and then you've got the fertilizer, and you can send that off in little bags to people, and then that works. So it's the nitrogen, which is 80% of the the hemisphere, what we've got up there in the atmosphere. So that should be easy. It may take a little bit of money to recreate the basically the machine that does that work, but it will be good.
Yes, but you're being positive. I was not being negative. I was just mentioning a new factor. Then these numbers are all going to change, and that's not good for the thing we care about, which is worldwide inflation and the long-term effects of the damage to our economy. All right, we'll leave the bad news alone. We've got through commodities. We must mention what happened in the last 24 hours. I do not understand football. You grew up in an atmosphere of football. England last won the World Cup in 1966, so it is 60 years since a victory. It was playing in a semifinal game, I believe, semifinal or quarterfinal, one or the other, against a team from Argentina. I'm not going to pursue what happened with the football game. I'm going to say that suddenly I saw headlines that I'd not seen for many decades about the Falklands War of 1980-81 and the Malvinas War of 1980-81. Simon, there are bad feelings, though it is 40 years later, there are bad feelings in both countries about that war. And it didn't get better with this football match. And though Argentina is not now headed by a dictator and is not now a brutal environment of Peronistas, it has, in fact, a man, Javier Milei, who's quite winning and charming and pro-Western entirely. Suddenly I saw a nasty streak, Simon, a nasty streak.
That is a nasty streak, and there's always a few people who have a nasty streak in them and they want to put it out there. And there were two things that really have clashed with Argentina and England particularly. One was the invasion of the Falkland Islands by Argentina's army, and then later that year, there was a soccer match where one of the Argentinian players punched the ball into the back of the net, and nobody saw it, who was one of the referees. And that would have been a not allowed goal, but it basically took the Argentinians to the next level of the World Cup at that point. And I think there's a lot of sore feelings there from Britain. And I know that with the Argentinians, there's a lot of sore feelings that they won't get what they call the Malvinas back as part of Argentina. It is what it is, and we can't do anything about that. But I do know that football is a good game, and it's about honor and playing hard and tough. And I don't mean that in a mean way. I mean, just it's a lot of running that these players do, and they have a lot of skill in it, both teams. I'm sad that England didn't make it through to the next level. But, you know the semifinals, that's pretty good.
Simon Constable, in the south of France, we're going to turn to a quiz that I guarantee will both entertain you and humiliate you about longevity in the United States of America. I'm John Batchelor. I'm John Batchelor with my good friend Simon Constable. He is in the south of France. He writes for the Wall Street Journal and Barron's and other distinguished publications. He has a new quiz up at the Wall Street Journal about longevity. Simon, introduce your quiz before you humiliate me and everybody else.
Okay, it's a quiz that's going to be hard because they're always hard, these ones, because I'm given topics and told to write about it, and I do my best. So we all know that life is finite, but some people live far longer than others, and it isn't always clear why longevity varies from person to person. Some point to genetics, others to wealth, and still others to where people live. I think they're all important. How much do you know? Well, I knew nothing. So if you get one question right, you've done better than me. So let's go with the first question. What is the average life expectancy at birth for the total U.S. population?
All right, there are five choices. 75 years, 77 years, 79 years, 81 years, 84 years. Drum roll. I got it wrong. How'd you do, Simon?
Well, I wrote this, so it's C, 79 years, which is it's up from 78.4 in 2023, and this is the 79 is for data from 2024. It takes a long time to get the data all collated and collected and all that sort of stuff. So, yes, 79 years, that's the average life expectancy for Americans, and I think that's a good long time. Question number two. Which U.S. state has the highest average life expectancy?
Drum roll.
Well, let's give you the choices that people might wonder. Hawaii, Massachusetts, Colorado, California, New Jersey. I'll let you guess.
I got it wrong. I know. I did this already. I got it wrong. What did I do wrong? Simon, this is not fair. Hawaii is not a member of the United States. It's in the Pacific Ocean.
And it has a little Union Jack on its flag. It's Hawaii, and I guess a lot of people could see that. It's a nice island or a nice few islands, and that's good. And people are very happy living there. And maybe it's because they're very happy that they're living longer. Let's go for a third one then.
All right.
Which state has the lowest life expectancy? Was it Indiana, Arkansas, Ohio, West Virginia, or Mississippi?
I got this one wrong, too, even though I was just guessing, and I figured I'll keep guessing. I'll get one right. All right, drum roll.
Drum roll. It's West Virginia, and West Virginia has a life expectancy of 72.2 years, according to the CDC.
Does this mean if you get on a plane in West Virginia and go to Hawaii, you'll live longer?
Basically, yes. I think that is what the conclusion must be. With that, and you know, life can be hard when you've got a coal mining business in the whole of West Virginia. That's a tough business. I grew up in a coal mining area too, and it's hard work.
I mentioned Simon's pitch for Hawaii. My testimony is I once spent 2 weeks in Hawaii on the beach in Waikiki and roaming around. The only thing I can say is I think I'm still there. Every day is the same. It's a dream. It never ends, and it can be a little boring, but it is perfect. So I see why they live longer. All right, the fourth question. This one's ridiculous, Simon. Go ahead.
Okay, so which of these three countries, and the countries are listed in threesomes, which of these countries have the highest longevity in the world according to United Nations data?
Go ahead.
A, which is Moldavia, Turkestan, Guyana, number two, which is the B question, South Korea, Canada, Italy, C is Faroe Islands, Singapore, Australia. D is Monaco, San Marino, and Hong Kong. And then E is Switzerland, Norway, and Estonia. Right. I wouldn't have got this.
Neither would Anthropic. Claude is raising his hand right now saying, hey, what? What is this? You've totally confused AI. All right.
What drum roll.
Yes, go ahead.
Drum roll, it's D, Monaco, San Marino, and Hong Kong.
We've left six questions for subsequent conversations with Simon Constable in the south of France. My goodness, Simon. What a quiz you've come up with now. Simon is in better temperatures than I left him the last time. I'm John Batchelor. Wonderful, Simon. Perfectly done.
You know, these questions, they're just, you know, it's like going, like looking at Einstein's formulas and what they're doing. And it's, you know, they're impossible. They're impossible, these things, or improbable, I should say.
Well, Simon,
thank you very much for your flexibility on having me on this day.
Simon, do you understand what your quizzes do? No matter that you're master of the universe, you're feeling really good about the deal you just closed. You sit down, you open up Simon's quiz, and you feel stupid.
That might be a bit, but it's not what I wanted. It's not what I wanted for that to be.
I'm going to submit this question four to Claudette. I'm gonna see if she gets it right. Okay,
and fine with me.
I will tell her to go looking for Simon Constable to correct him if you're wrong.
I get a bit of that frequently. Anyway, this is good.
Oh,
thank you, bro.
Another detail about your previous quiz, the Tech Center quiz. I sent you an item this morning from the Wall Street Journal. Did you get a chance to look at it?
Yes, I did, and that was very worrying. These are Luddites are threatening the lives of people who are running data centers or the companies that are basically pushing for more artificial intelligence operations, and they're doing things which is completely illegal and immoral. You know, the world will change. And it continues changing, and it always will. But, you know, new jobs pop up, and they will.
Let me read the headline. The AI backlash has tech executives fearing for their lives. Violent threats against AI companies are rising and spilling over into real-world security incidents. We know that there's resistance. We know that it's not based on good information. It's based on assumptions and past instances. But, Simon, this is not good. Death threats on social media.
No, it isn't. And people showing up with Molotov cocktails to throw at people's houses or their buildings, you know, their offices and all that sort of stuff. It's just not good. It's not the way to do these things. It seems irresponsible, evil even. It's just not the right thing to do. People running those data centers are employing a lot of people, and they're doing their best every day.
I want to say, I know that facts won't reverse this. This is about fear. I understand that. But I want to make it very clear that the evidence so far about AI is that it doesn't replace people. It does not do that. What it does, in fact, is make new opportunities for everyone. And that there's no reason to fear that it's going to take your job. Your job will change and you will be endorsed by your working with AI. It's all very happy. And
yeah, it is.
It's a tool. How would we be doing right now, Simon and myself, in this conversation, if we took away Zoom, StreamYard, iMac, my keyboards, my iPhone, my Rodemaster processor, my Generac backup outside because I'm in the country and the power's down again. You take all that away. What do we have? Where is our job, Simon? It doesn't exist.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. This is these new technologies over the last quarter of a century have been amazing and have opened opportunities to so many people over so many years, and it will continue to do that. And we should embrace it. And I realize change is not something that most people like. But once you dive in, it's like diving in the swimming pool the first time when you were a child and learning to swim. You know, probably was a little bit scary, but, you know, you get over it and you say, well, wow, I get to go swimming in a pool. That's lovely.
Let's do sentimental. In 2009, when the Great Recession hit, Simon and myself, in order to do what we're now doing, we had to go to a building on Times Square and go inside and get permission to sit down. And there was a recording camera somewhere in front of us. And we would do, 33 or 4 minutes on the markets. And we'd turn out these little packages and put them into Market Watch, I think is where they were viewed.
Yeah.
And that all that technology was ungainly and difficult, and Simon had to solve it, even though he was also working as a videographer at the Wall Street Journal. And the Wall Street Journal was treating what you were doing, Simon, as unnecessary, as not profit-making, when in fact it's turned into what we're doing now. And talk about profit-making. We don't need cable television because we can do this, and everybody can do this. But that's 2009. What is that? My math is not so good. Is that 17 years? Yeah, 17 years.
Yeah, it's 17 years ago, and that's not very long, you know, in the sort of the speed
that was the
at
great
which
recession.
Things have changed.
Remember, we had the pigs, Portugal,
the pigs.
Ireland, Italy, Greece, and Spain.
Spain, yeah. Right. They were there, and they're still pretty much in that same situation. Maybe it's a little bit better than it was, but not very good at all. Yeah, it's fascinating, the whole thing. And the speed is amazing. And the people who think of these things, like the iPhone came out of nowhere. Yeah, I say nowhere. I mean, it was Apple, but it was a new way of looking at things and how a phone could operate, not just as a phone, but as a browser and all other things. It has a camera in it, et cetera, et cetera. Really impressive.
In addition, hiring in America, there are not enough people to fill the skilled jobs that are going wanting. Skilled jobs. You have a skill. You're in demand anywhere. And I'm talking about skill like welding, skill like on AI, skill with Anthropic, anything like that. You're going to be hired several times. And you have your choice of jobs, and you can move between jobs, lots of jobs. I know my children have competent, because they have skills, very different kinds of skills. One's digital and one's manual. And the female's manual is surprising. She's a project manager for high-end rebuild in Manhattan, Simon. How rarefied is that?
That's rarefied. That's a good gig. That's a good gig. You know? And it needs it. The city's buildings are getting old, so they need to have new ones.
And you can't build in Manhattan because of the various committees that would review your applications that would take for years. So what they do is they take an older building and rebuild it from the inside. Isn't that clever, Simon? So you don't have
that is very clever. That's very clever and a very smart thing. Look, it's no different than it was. Just we've made it more safe or safer, depending on how you want to say that. But that's good.
One more detail about what we're living with about tech centers. Tech centers connect eventually to Silicon Valley. All Silicon Valley is now AI. Everybody's plugging into AI. The Mag7, doesn't matter what you do, you have a connection to AI. It's a tool. That's why. We're not talking about magic here. But California is in the process of rejecting its billionaires. And that is part of, I think, this fear, Simon. The idea that there's such a thing as too rich and that rich people are not wanted. In fact,
let me butt in here a minute. One of the things I've noticed about America almost from day one is that the very richest people in America tend to try to get rid of all their earnings or their wealth before they die. They want to pass this on so it has a huge legacy. And I'm not going to name names with this, but it's pretty obvious who they're. The only one I could think of that isn't alive is Andrew Carnegie. He wanted to spend a lot of money so that people could benefit from his wealth. And that includes the Carnegie Hall in you know, and not many other countries have that way of thinking. When people are rich, they're doing that. And I think that's a good, it's a good thing. It's like, look, I've made a ton of money, but here I'm paying it all back to the country that made me successful. Great. What's wrong with that?
I connected to this fact that this fear and threat of AI that we cannot overcome with facts, Simon. I mean, I'm aware of the fact that some fears can't be answered and that you have to live through them. You and I don't fear AI because we live on it and we've gotten used to it. And it actually is a way of expressing what we do because of our technology. But if you fear it and you don't understand how it's part of your life, it can become the thing you blame for whatever else is going on. I understand the psychology of that. But I did not know it had gotten to the point of threatening people's lives. I did not know that.
And I think that's terrible. I hope the police are going to investigate that sort of stuff because it shouldn't happen to anyone, you know, and any threats to people who are just trying to run a legal business, you know, that should be left alone.
In addition, we'll mention that the tech centers are here. They're not leaving. They're not going away. We're not talking about something that you have to decide on. They're contributing to the income of municipalities and states right now. And that money is translated into lighter tax load for the rest of the population, and that translates into wealth for your family. All of these things are related. But we're preaching, Simon. We shouldn't. We should go back to 2009 when we felt like renegades dashing into the NASDAQ.
I remember that very, very well. And it was a lot of fun, but it was very different from now when you can just flip the laptop open and do an interview and then move on. You know, it's fast now. It's very fast.
And the Trump administration and the former Starmer government and the Macron government and the Maloney government and the Merz government are all dealing with the same thing we're dealing with. Reporting is now in the hands of professionals who used to be called amateurs, but they're not. Yesterday, I watched a video with three veterans of the Department of Justice, one who had been a U.S. attorney in the Southern District of New York. He's famous, Preet Bharara. And his two colleagues, one of whom had been one of his at Southern District of New York, another had been at a U.S. attorney in the Southern state, I believe in Alabama, but I'm not sure. Anyway, they were discussing the nomination hearings of Mr. Blanche, who's nominated to be Department of Justice Attorney General. And they were carrying on this conversation three parts of the United States, the South, Manhattan, and I believe somewhere out west. And they had smooth relations with each other because they'd worked together for years. It was charming to watch. They didn't need a moderator. They didn't need a reporter. They didn't need a voice coming in on CNN. They didn't need any of that. They had opinions. They were well-spoken. They shared the microphone. Well, in this case, it was three people across. We're two people across now. And you respected their profession. They were not trained journalists. They're prosecutors. You understand the difference. Good heavens.
There's a big difference. There's a big difference there,
But what they knew... We wanted to know. We don't need a reporter at the Department of Justice telling us that Preet Bharara thinks this. We have Preet Bharara himself. And all of that technology is now available to everyone. And if you have difficulty with tech centers, I recommend you go on Zoom and talk about it with somebody.
That would actually be very, very interesting. I mean, what we've got at the moment is just amazing. And I would say to everybody, it doesn't require a lot of money to be able to do broadcasts. It really doesn't. You can do it with a very regular, you know, not expensive laptop and some earbuds. And they don't have to be expensive at all. So it's not going to break anybody's back.
And Simon, I figure, Simon, we're about 8,000 miles apart. I'm not sure what the gap is. No, not
well, it's further than I can swim. I know that much.
About 4,000 miles apart, I think.
Yeah.
Somewhere in the 3 or 4 range. And we can carry on we can gossip as if we're in the garden. So it's wonderful. Thank you, Simon, for your time.
And, thank you for yours.
And it is wonderful to hear your weather has moderated. But you know it's coming back. You know this.
Yes, I will cry then. You'll be able to see the gush of tears coming down my cheeks, going, oh, no.
And next week, we will continue the humiliation of the longevity quiz, I promise.
That'll be fun. Okay, have a good day.
Let me get the Roman music going here, and we'll bow it together. All right, boys and girls, Simon and I are leaving the stage. It's all yours. Union cards, yes, everybody good. Here we go. Thank you. Good evening on a summer's evening. This is live. We're streaming the Londinium Chronicles. I am Gaius. Germanicus is here. We're in our minority participating and on the wine bar by the Thames. The centurions have gathered early. It's a beautiful evening. The shopping was especially hectic this afternoon, but the families have gone home. The centurions are staying with us because they want to hear what we have to say about these disruptions in the ceasefire, Strait of Hormuz, the ceasefire in Lebanon, the increasingly effective drone contest between Russia and Ukraine. And then there is the matter of the American Civil War. Germanicus and I will comment as we close tonight our thoughts of 1863 and the 3 days in Gettysburg, the 1st of July, the 2nd of July, and the 3rd of July, when the Union Army and the Confederate Army under Lee met on a battlefield that was prepared by God. If and when you visit Gettysburg, you'll see it is perfect ground for a battle as they fought in the 19th century. Battle that sometimes you can say was political. Other times you could argue that it was human sacrifice. And the consequence of that battle remain with us 150, 200, 500 years later, here in the 21st century. We're, however, going to have fun with Ukraine and with the Strait of Hormuz. There are headlines for me to mention, because this will very clearly distort some of the reporting these next days. Record heat wave disrupts Europe as France warns death toll to rise. Last week, they were capable of 44 degrees centigrade in the southwest west of France. That's 112. And it's very dry. Very, very dry. No humidity whatsoever. It's dangerous to be outside in 112. I will talk to France again next week. But right now, 1,000 excess deaths during the heat wave in France. The heat wave extends from Britain through Paris to Milan, right across the map of Europe. Not in the U.S., not yet. However, in the Strait of Hormuz, we've had several days now of ceasefire. By that, they mean they only shoot once. Iranians shoot, U.S. shoots back. Iranians shoot, U.S. shoots back. Similar to what goes on in Lebanon when they call it a ceasefire. There's an agreement between the Lebanese government and the Israeli government. First time. But that's not significant. The IDF and the Hezbollah that are in contest with each other. We're going to begin none of the above. We're going to begin with the observation from Reuters in these last hours that the Kremlin hawks are pressing Putin, pressing him very hard. The word harry is not adequate. Threaten is too much. Pressing. That he must wrap the story up. Okay, buddy.